Hi, everyone. This is Yin, and welcome to Growth and Failure. This show highlights extraordinary people that inspire and motivate me to level up. I'll have conversations with a wide range of profiles, from entrepreneurs and athletes, investors to educators, you name it. I love hearing people's different journeys. For me, the biggest lessons learned and opportunities to grow come from the struggle, the pain, the defeat. And I hope hearing these stories inspire you to not fear that messy middle or failure, but rather motivates you to reflect, to keep learning, and ultimately to keep growing. For more information, please visit growthandfailure.com for more updates, and please write a review if you can. They really do help other people find this show. Thanks for listening. This is the story of Allison Bishop, president and co-founder of Proof Trading, an institutional equities execution platform. In this episode, we cover Allison's journey from aspirations in creative writing, which had a rejection and led her down a path that was much more quantitatively oriented than she thought, and then led her to a master's and a PhD, including math and computer science and cryptology. I learned so much from her, like the branch of math called combinatorics, which I've never heard before, and also the practical applications of cryptology and computer science, and for the first time, finally understanding how those are actually used. But more importantly, I learned about controlling how you set people's expectations and reclaiming that power, either emotionally, physically. Allison literally changed the way she moved in the world, and I absolutely loved her growth that she shared. Please enjoy this interview with the delightful multi-hyphenate Allison Bishop. Hi, Allison. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining. And first off, thank you to the top gun, best of the best head trader out there, Jason Feinberg, for the introduction. I remember we were talking about everything from investing in business and comedy, and that's when your name came up. And I had heard your name before through work, but specifically when we're talking about comedy. And he said, Yin, there's this brilliant person that you need to know. She's a computer scientist, cryptographer, comedian. And I said, wait a minute. Hold on. I said, thank you for being a polymath and letting me use alliteration there. But it's not every day I get the three C's on my show. So before we get into unwinding all of that from computer science, cryptography, and your comedian and just really funny writing, you are a leading expert in cryptography, which is just wild. Before we get into what that is, because I have a lot of basic questions on that, maybe we could rewind before your encrypted work days and start from the beginning, because I like to hear about people's childhood and where they grew up. So if you don't mind starting from there and sharing where you grew up.
I actually have a family joke about this because my mother always forgets what state I was born in. And that's always used as a security question. And one time, I think I was at the hospital to get some minor procedure and they asked us, what state were you born in? And my mother said Ohio and I said Indiana at the same time. And then my mom goes, ah, she's probably right. And so I moved around a fair amount as a kid. I was born in Indiana, despite my mother not remembering. We moved on my second birthday to Ohio. We moved from there to Memphis, Tennessee. And then I went to the last part of middle school and high school in upstate New York in a tiny little town called Lansing near a slightly bigger town called Ithaca, which people may have heard of. From there, I've lived in a bunch of other places too. So it's hard to say I'm from somewhere, but mostly Midwest. A lot of people ask upon hearing this, was your father in the military? No, that would have made more sense. He just likes to quit jobs and then dramatically go at least 500 miles away for the next one. So it's more following him through that process.
Is there a certain city or state that resonated with you growing up that you remember the most or think fondly of or not so fondly of?
No, honestly, no. They're all the same. I think one thing about growing up moving a lot is that you learn how much things are different and the same every place you go. And it definitely has been one of those experiences that gives me the confidence to just float through a lot of different spaces and communities and feel, like, okay, I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to learn the rules of this community and how things go. Because yeah, there isn't as much differentiation as I would have expected.
Did you remember it being easy every time your parents said, oh, guess what? We're moving to whatever city or state. I moved a couple times growing up, but the biggest one was in middle school for me. And that was a tough transition for me and my siblings who moved junior year in high school and senior year in high school. And it was at the time that my parents didn't really think about that type of transition for children. For you, it sounds like in hindsight, it was a really wonderful thing because you just adapted strongly. But a lot of people aren't able to, but did you think about those transitions with ease?
Definitely not. At the time, they were super scary. And there were things that got lost along the way that I'm still regretful of. Because, for instance, I'm a very short person. There are very few sports that it makes sense for me to do, but I'm also very competitive and athletic, and I love doing sports. And so I was doing gymnastics in Ohio at a gym there. And when we moved, my parents just didn't bother to find me a new gymnastics gym. So I stopped at the age of 10, very much against my will. And I'm still sad about that. A lot of things you can go back and do as an adult. And I feel like it's never too late to do those things that you wanted to do. But gymnastics, unfortunately, is not like that. So it's not the same as a 39-year-old trying to learn gymnastics. So I'm still working on my handstands. So it definitely was hard. And some things got lost along the way.
Do you have a close relationship with your parents? And do you have siblings?
I have two siblings. I'm a middle child. My sister also works in finance. She works on the consumer banking side at Citibank these days. She's the oldest. And my younger brother is a professional comedy writer and director out in LA.
Wide spectrum, although you seem to be that Venn diagram for the siblings.
I interpolate between the two of them a little bit.
I like to fast forward once I hear about where people grew up and their family and their siblings and parents is college, because I'm fascinated by how that is transformative for so many people. And yet here we are, we have to make this decision when we're 17 or 18 to pick the biggest choice of our lives that really sets us off in so many different ways, but professionally and personally. So I'm curious, how did you choose Princeton, math major, but what was your decision-making process?
This is not something I think about as a slice of time in my life, because my father is a college admissions director. So he would go from college to college. So my entire life has been steeped in the college experience. But it was very funny because people always expected me to have a lot of help in thinking about college and applying for college. And that was not at all the case. He was extremely hands-off. After I had decided on Princeton, he was not at all particularly encouraging about my chances of getting in. And he had personally met, you know, the dean of admissions at Princeton. Yeah, I don't know. Fred's a weird guy. I could go either way. Was not very helpful. But I think what was super helpful, and what I think is sadly becoming more and more rare with the pressure and people going into college these days, is my parents were completely blasé about where you went to college. You have to go to college. Everyone in my family went to college, has a master's degree, but they were very open to, there's a ton of good schools out there. There's a ton of good programs. Just pick one. It's not that hard. So they were not focused on getting in any one place. But my decision-making process was somewhat strange because I wanted to be a writer. So I was looking at mostly creative writing programs. So my list was Princeton for their creative writing programs. Toni Morrison was there at the time. And then Williams and then Notre Dame, which is where my parents went. That was my top three. So it has no relation to my career after that. In the theme of this podcast, the thing that happened that set me on a very different path, I actually got rejected from the Princeton creative writing program. So I got into Princeton. I went to Princeton. I was planning to major in English and minor in creative writing. And the first semester freshman year, you apply to take the writing seminars. And it's roughly, I think at that time, 50-50 whether you get into that semester. And the idea is you reapply and you keep doing it. But I didn't get in and I was devastated. This entire point that I was here, what am I even doing? And at the time, I was also supposed to be just getting rid of my general distribution requirements. One of those was to take a math course. And I refused to take Calc, which was what most people were taking. I'd taken Calc AB in high school and I found it kind of boring. And so they're like, you could just take Calc 2. Now what else you got? I ended up taking number theory because I thought it was the physics for poets of math. It is not. It's a foundational course of cryptography, and it was a course that introductory math majors were taking, and it set me on this very different path of learning that I liked math and that math could be creative. But it happened because of this simultaneous confluence events that I got rejected from creative writing and that I refused to take calculus. So that was the combination of things.
I love that failure. And I also love that you were disappointed that the class wasn't physics for poetry enthusiasts.
I also did take the Physics for Poets version at Princeton. And I thought it was great. It was really philosophical and insightful, and I quite enjoyed it. But yeah, but the math class was not at all that. It was a serious math class. And I also had no conception of what Princeton math as a department was or what that meant. And I'm really glad I didn't know, because I think I would have found it very intimidating. I got pretty deep into this process as a math major before people started like telling me, You do know this is one of the best math programs in the world. Oh, no, I did not know that. Yeah, you know, the guy teaching linear algebra is a Fields medalist. What's a Fields medal? And it was just very perplexing to the people around me how I got there, because there's usually about 60 to 100 people every year applying to Princeton for math. And in my year, only 15 graduated with that major. And I ended up being this wild card person who did not know what was going on, but was in for the ride.
I love how you get into one of the most competitive programs by happenstance because you couldn't get into the writing program. I'm curious, this math class that really sounded like it was transformative for you, at least, how did it teach you that math was creative?
Well, it was the first time I'd actually gotten to write proofs. This concept of using math, not as a vehicle to just calculate something, but as a way of reasoning about the world, that was new to me. Because I feel we lose so many opportunities in the way we teach math at the elementary, middle school, and high school level. Here's a procedure, and you do it. If we're lucky, here's what that means. But there's not, here's how people came up with it. Here's the history of it, or here's the question from first principles and have you come up with the procedure. So the first time having these open-ended questions be asked, and then having to reason about it myself, assemble proofs out of the building blocks that we'd seen in the class. The one that I think fascinated me at first, which is actually a relatively simple one that you can teach in the middle school level, which is a proof that there are infinitely many prime numbers. The fact that you could prove there is infinitely many of something as complicated as prime numbers was fascinating to me. And the creativity that goes into, okay, how do I reason about this? How do I create a procedure to always produce a new prime outside of the set of primes that I've produced so far? That constructive building process was very appealing to me.
You're getting me excited about math. So when you're doing these proof statements, and this is where I'm not as familiar, but when you're writing it and you realize how creative it is and you're going through, at the end of it, is it still the same answer in that here it is, very black and white, and then QED?
Not really. And I think this is something that mathematicians are at varying degrees of denial about, because there is this process of peer review that happens when we prove new theorems and people put them out. And it's highly non-trivial to go through and check someone else's proof and make sure everything makes sense. And in some sense, when we can reduce each little step to this logic axioms, then you can check that and we mostly gain confidence. But the process of putting those things together really shapes the theorems that you're proving. So it's not really that there's this universe of facts, and then there's these proofs that get attached to the facts. And then as long as we have a proof attached to the fact that we can check, we can move on. There's so many different things that we could reason about, or relationships between objects that we could try to prove theorems about. So much more of the interesting stuff goes into the human process of what do we find worth studying? What questions do we ask? And oftentimes when we prove something in a different way, it leads to the same theorem statement, but it leads to different follow-up questions or different things that we might explore from there. And I think mathematicians are a little bit reticent to admit how subjective the process of curating what's important and what things we study is, because if the process of checking a proof is already non-trivial, but is solvable in some sense, but the process of deciding which proofs are worth doing and which questions are worth investigating is where most of the fun stuff happens.
And so, with your fun and creative degree in math from Princeton, what did you end up doing next?
I had no idea what I wanted to do. I still had no real understanding of what mathematicians do for a job. I knew mathematician as a term, but I'm like, well, what does that mean in terms of companies? And one of the only examples that I had seen was doing a summer internship for the NSA. So I had done a code breaking internship. So that was one example of what a mathematician does. But I knew I wanted to do much more public facing and social impact things. So I didn't want to go into classified research full time, because then you get hidden behind that wall. But I had no real understanding of what a mathematician does other than a mathematician goes to grad school. So I went to do my master's at the University of Cambridge in a program they call the Part Three MAS, which is super fun. And it's a one-year master's program where you pick and choose from all the different math courses however you want. And at the end, you have to take some number of exams to pass the class. So I did that in the hopes that by being able to sample different areas of mathematics, I might figure out what I wanted to do. And I figured out that I love combinatorics. And then I went to a PhD program in a place that had no combinatorists. So it's back in the drawing board of figuring out what I wanted to do when I started my PhD at the University of Texas.
Can I ask, what math term did you just say?
Combinatorics.
It sounds like a dinosaur, but if you could expand.
It does. I forget what TV show I was watching, but sometimes TV shows talk about math very briefly and don't hire the right consultants. And there was one show that I was watching where they called it combinatronics, and I almost spit out my drink. Who told you that? But combinatorics, so the root of the word comes from combining things. And it's basically the simplified explanation is that it's a study of counting objects, which makes it sound super easy. But it actually includes all of the study of analyzing network graphs and permutations and relationships between objects at very fundamental levels. People who study epidemics and how they grow through graphs, and people who study social networks, all of that touches upon and leverages combinatorics.
Here you are getting your PhD at the University of Austin, thinking that you could focus on that, but you can't. So what do you end up doing there for your PhD work?
Math separates into two subfields for me, at least the way I think about it. Some of them have very complicated objects, and then you prove relatively simple theorems about them. So all the complication goes into the objects themselves. And so there's things like topology, which is about shapes in the world and things like that, and algebraic geometry. And combinatorics is more like the objects are pretty simple. Graphs, you've got dots and you've got lines connecting the dots or things. But then the theorems and the patterns that you study on them are complicated, which is much more aligned with computer science, how I ended up wandering from math to computer science. So as an early PhD student at Austin, I would go around to the different mathematicians in the department and try to learn about their research. And I would always ask them, what is the application of this in the world? And I got a range of answers from there aren't any applications of this in the world to, oh, it has tons of applications to other areas of math. And so I was pretty underwhelmed by the potential impact of the things that were being studied. And there's a lot of fundamental research that happens that we don't know yet how it's going to get applied, and it eventually gets applied. And I think that stuff is really cool, but from the perspective of I have one life and I like being very people-facing and doing things that impact people directly wasn't really compelling enough to me. So I started wandering over to the computer science department. And this was another situation where I had no idea that the University of Texas at Austin computer science department is like top 10 computer science department in the country. I was just wandering in and taking classes and started getting captivated by things happening over there in terms of learning theory and studying, which is the basis of machine learning, and cryptography and complexity theory and other things, which are basically just math with better funding. So it's always a joke I make to mathematicians. What are you guys doing over here? It's all the same stuff, but it's got much better research grants in computer science, and it's much more potentially impactful and relevant pretty directly. So I ended up switching halfway through my PhD to be in the computer science department, which meant doing all of the requirements again from scratch. So I basically did two PhDs and left with one of them. So totally the wrong way to do it. But I ended up in a good place, sort of finishing my PhD with an emphasis in cryptography in the computer science department.
I love rewinding a little bit from that story and also your Princeton, how you serendipitously end up at the top programs. And it reminds me of the quote that Reese Witherspoon's character, Elle Woods, said in
Legally Blonde.
Legally Blonde, where she's doing some Harvard proof and she goes, what, like it's hard?
Yeah, is it supposed to be hard?
I'm sure. I'll just switch to PhD program. Sure. What was it about what you focused on with the computer science specialty and the focus on cryptography that was interesting to you? And also, it sounds like you were very curious and talked to a lot of the professors to say, what is the use case of this? What is the practical application? What was it about computer science and or cryptography that excited you or resonated with you?
Part of the reason why I'm still involved in cryptography and why it's so captivating to me is it's very fundamentally the study of how people communicate. Because cryptography at its essence is about, a lot of people would describe it as about keeping secrets, but I don't think about it that way. Because the easiest way to keep secrets is to not communicate. That problem is solved. You just don't tell people things. It's the much more nuanced problem of how do I control who gets to see what in my information? Or how do I control what information I give to whom and still be able to have conversations and get what I have transactions on the internet and do what I need to do? It's a lot of really fascinating tools for separating the core atoms of communication and computation so that we can really control what goes where. Public key encryption is a way of separating the ability to talk to someone from the ability for you to read their messages. I can encrypt to someone and only they can read it. And so you have that separation of powers almost, that you can really build entire new ways of facilitating communication on top of cryptography. And I think that is fascinating to me. And so what appealed to me about computer science is that it's a field that's fundamentally embedded in our daily lives. And in particular, the way that we can interact with people and scale our interactions and our communications while still being in control of that. And so that was very appealing to me as a problem space to work in.
Well, the way you describe cryptography is very beautiful philosophically. When I think about it, it blurs with cryptocurrency. And what I think about is that scene in The Matrix where the green letters and numbers come on. That's what I think of, all that language. And so I think it's just me being intimidated by it. But if you could describe, and you did already, but simply how cryptography, the way you described it was more of the philosophy of why you like it versus, can you give me a practical use case of how you think about it today? And how me as a pedestrian walking through can think about the main street person's application of cryptography.
Probably the application that we all use the most every day is just sending a credit card number over the internet. You have a trusted party on the other side that you want to communicate with, but what you don't have is a trusted channel of that communication. We all know that the way things are networked today, if I'm doing something on my phone, it's going to pass through so many different layers of technology and so many different companies and pieces of hardware until it gets to ultimately where it's going. And so what that means is that we really can't trust all of the intermediary communication. So we need to be able to encrypt our data in such a way that it can pass through all those hops and not be vulnerable to, if somebody reads it along the way, they can get our credit card information. Basic use case of cryptography is basically that point-to-point communication. When I'm trying to talk to someone I trust who I want to get my credit card number at the end of the day to process the transaction, but everything in between is untrusted, is a wild west, and I want to protect the contents of my communication from that intermediary. That's the core thing that most cryptography was designed to do. It's built up a lot from there to much more complicated things where it's, what if I have medical data that's sensitive sitting in six different places? How do I aggregate it and do the results of clinical studies without compromising the individual privacy? Cryptography has a lot to say about that. And then also cryptocurrency, which I stay very far away from personally, but the underlying math is a lot of the same stuff, because in cryptocurrency is one of the main things is, how do I prove that I'm the person who owns the coin when I'm trying to make a transaction with it? And that's all the same authentication and confidentiality that encryption and signatures and other tools in cryptography were designed to provide.
I feel like I understand it way more in a practical sense based on that description for the first time. So thank you for that. And so here you are, you graduated with a PhD in computer science at UT Austin. You have a master's in math and also undergrad at Princeton in math. What do you do for your first job with all these degrees?
And that's where I also didn't really know what to do. So I kept going in academia, which is the natural thing, which is not an easy gig to get because it is a pyramid scheme. You come in and every professor trains many grad students and there aren't academic positions for all of them. So it was a very painful process. I did a postdoc at Microsoft Research, which was great. It was a wonderful experience at their lab in Boston. But that's continuation of the academic journey. So the researchers there work on very similar academic things. They just don't teach. So I love the teaching aspect. So that would have not been appealing to me for the long term because I wanted to have teaching be a core part of my career. So I then went on the faculty job market and interviewed at, I think, a total of 12 different universities for entering tenure track job. And I ended up starting as an assistant professor at Columbia in 2013, which is 1 year after finishing my PhD in 2012.
And at that point, did you think you wanted to stay within academia, but be a teacher full time for, you mentioned tenure, but that was your goal at the time?
Yeah. So my goal at the time was to just build my academic career doing the core functions of teaching and research and writing research grants and having PhD students and all that stuff. And I thought, I finally made it. I will be happy here forever, which of course lasted like 3 years.
Specifically, when you were a professor at Columbia and thinking about your research, what was your focal point then? What did you want to solve or probably win the Nobel Prize for? But what was your area of focus?
Well, there are two different mathematical branches of cryptography in the kind of cryptography that I was building. The mathematical foundations split into stuff that's based on number theory and elliptic curve, and stuff that's based on linear algebra and finite fields, which is lattices. So the details of that are not important, but it's basically there's these two parallel tracks that people have been building cryptography from. And it really annoyed me that they were separate. We would build something in track A and then build it in track B and go back and forth all the time. One of the core problems I was working on was I wanted to build a bridge between the tracks. So I wanted to really understand why is it that these two different fields of mathematics both seem to generate all the same cryptography tools? There must be something fundamentally the same about their underlying structure that allows us to base all this stuff on either one of them. And so instead of doing it piece by piece, I wanted to build the translator between the two. It did not work. It does not exist to this day. So I worked on a lot of problems where we knew how to do it in one and not the other, and trying to translate some of the ideas back and forth.
Do you think that it's still solvable, or and your interests got off path, or is that something that you don't think is possible?
I think it's possible. I think it's still too much to be coincidence. The thing I became less convinced of over time was that there would really be impact to solving these things. And so I think my journey followed this progression from becoming more applied. So starting out very theoretical as a mathematician, coming a little more applied by default as a computer scientist, and becoming more and more interested in the actual applications of what happens when we put these things in practice. Because what drew me to cryptography in the first place was that people use this stuff and that communication is important and we're facilitating that. But then watching that play out, I spent my PhD building up these theoretical tools to build cryptography systems from. And then I get to the point, I have my toolkit, I want to do stuff. And the academic research world was not really focused on putting the things into practice and then dealing with all the pain that comes from putting things into practice. And there's certainly a lot of people in academia who do very cool work on that front. But I was a little dissatisfied by the theoretical research directions becoming more and more disconnected from the on-the-ground difficulties. Because as we all know, as users of cryptography, it's usually not somebody breaks some fancy math and that's why things go wrong. Somebody uses 1234 as a password and that's why things go wrong. And so I felt like I needed to be working more on the human interaction part of the design space, which is not really a math problem. And it's very hard to study as a math problem. And so you need to be more interdisciplinary. And you also need to be more embedded in the economy. Because a lot of the reasons why we don't have better protection on our data privacy and all these things in our communication is not because the math doesn't exist. It's because there's no economic incentive for companies to do it. So I wanted to get more insight into the industry challenges of cryptography and basically of anything that was interesting to me that I wanted to think about in terms of industry. I felt completely ill-equipped to think about as an academic. And it started also making me nervous as a teacher that I was preparing students to go get jobs that I had never had and didn't know anything about. And there was a certain guilt of students coming back from their tech interviews with their algo questions, and I'd be able to help them prepare for that thing. And then they would say, okay, so what else should I do to prepare for my software engineering job? I've never had a software engineering job. I have no idea. And I would talk to other academics about this who'd been in academia their whole careers, and they would say, oh, yeah, it just doesn't bother me. Nobody had a good answer. How do you, as an academic researcher, aim your research at the things that are going to be practical if you've never worked on practical things? I had to get out there and practice instead of just being a theoretician if I wanted to do work that would ultimately be practical.
It's interesting, rewinding a little bit, you mentioned just the economic incentives that different businesses and industries need to have. I actually think it's also education and awareness. I think one of the things you do really well is you're a curious individual, but you have the power of mixing the truly interdisciplinary mindset and also skill to see that and have interest in learning more about it and then combining it. So here you are, co-founder and president of Proof Trading. So it combines a lot of things you talked about already, the math part, the application part, making impact. How did you get from that point of third year professor at Columbia to where you are today in the intersection of business, government, economics, trading, math, and cryptography too? But Would love to hear how that bridge was gapped.
I mostly think about that process as a process of my office getting progressively less nice. I had this lovely private corner office at Columbia that I even got to choose the paint color, and it had a door that I could shut. And then I went to working for IEX, the stock exchange, as a quantitative researcher with a desk on a trading floor. And then to being a startup founder where I was working from home from my coffee table. And along for the ride in this progression, my boyfriend at the time, when I was an assistant professor and now my husband, I would keep coming home and saying, you know how when we met, I was a tenure track professor at an Ivy League institution. I'm going to resign from that. And I'm going to work for a stock exchange. Okay. And then a few months later, you know how I said I was going to have a stable job at a stock exchange? I'm actually going to co-found a startup. Okay. It's definitely been a sequence of events that I did not plan exactly. But the way that it happened was sort of feeling restless in my role at Columbia, looking for ways to be more directly impactful in research. I had this idea of, oh, well, I'll do part-time consulting because the academics can do up to 20% of their time consulting. I ended up meeting my co-founder, Dan Azen, who is a co-founder of IEX, at a pub crawl at a Forbes conference. This is very, very random. And I had just read Michael Lewis's book, Flash Boys, which is about IEX. So I recognized the name on the business card that he gave me. Oh, yeah, I read about you guys. It sounds pretty cool. And we were just friends for a year, both living in New York, and I would complain to him about academics working on useless stuff, and he would complain to me about nobody passing his quant research interview. And at some point, just come and work with us on things.
It reminds me of that scene in Step Brothers with John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell. Did we just become best friends?
Something like that, yeah. So I started working with them as a consultant while still teaching and getting my PhD students through their research process. But it's just the case, things move fast in industry. And if you're there one day a week, you're there on Mondays, and then a lot of stuff happens and you come back the next Monday. And, oh no, why did you do that? That's not what I said. I felt like I couldn't be as impactful or as useful as I wanted to be one day a week. So I ended up then flipping it and being full-time at IEX and still teaching part-time and part-time advising my PhD students. Soon after that, Dan and I, for various reasons, decided that we wanted to start our own business and to start a broker. And one of the main reasons was we kind of hit a place of diminishing returns. We'd built up these tools at IEX at the exchange layer that we thought were pretty effective at preventing certain latency arbitrage and high frequency trading. And we could see them working and they worked pretty well. So we felt we could have more impact working on a different layer of the system as a broker and continuing to tinker and iterate on the exchange product. The timing was 2019, great time to start a business, thinking that everything's going to go well. So we ended up jumping ship and starting proof trading in 2019, and that's what we're still working on.
Before I ask more questions about proof, can you describe when you first joined IEX officially and whether you were still at Columbia or not? How did you get up to speed on all things related to trading and finance? I'm just curious because at the time you didn't have any exposure. And so here you are jumped in right on the trading floor and you had a desk there. What was your learning curve like and what was that process? I'm sure you got it quickly because it seems like you're just a sponge, but just to see that learning process specifically with investments.
I think that perhaps cryptography and finance are similar fields in that they both try to scare people away with enough acronyms. They both have this tactic of the FTCH of the XYW. Why or whatever it is, and you're supposed to know what it is. So I was somewhat comfortable at that point being the person who just asked everyone questions all the time. And so my strategy on the trading floor was great because you're just sitting in the middle of all these people. And whenever they take their headphones off, I would ask them a question. That was basically my function. I would look around me and if somebody took their headphones off, I'd be like, hey, I'm wondering what what this graph means. Can you come over here? So part of it is just being shameless about asking questions. But I think also just having that prior experience of learning a jargon heavy field, knowing that the fact that I didn't know what the things was, one, didn't mean I was stupid. And two, didn't mean it was going to be hard. It just meant that I had to ask. Although I do think finance makes it unusually tough. I've also been documenting some of my process of this, which Proof has put out a market structure primer which is basically my writing down the things that I didn't know and therefore asked and putting that into a form that hopefully helps other people. Because we do think that unlike cryptography, where there's textbooks and there's public facing things and surveys that are helpful, in finance, you're piecing this together from different people's memories and heads. I'm in the middle of the trading floor asking, what does this four-letter code mean on this trade flag? There's no public references for so much of this. So I do think as a field, we need to do a better job of giving people friendlier entry points. But the people in the trading floor at IEX around me were great at just having the patience to answer a million questions.
Fast forward to proof trading. What did you and your co-founder want to solve or assist with?
The biggest surprise to me learning about the stock trading system was that the entire purpose of stock trading is to provide public information about prices. That's the whole reason for being of the stock market. And yet, absolutely every structure around that is completely opaque, which I just think is ludicrous. I will make the same argument with people about pay transparency. We need better insight into where these prices are coming from for exactly the same reasons that we need public price discovery for stocks. But taking it specifically to the broker layers, what we saw from our seat at IEX was that we were trying to build tools that would ultimately help long-term investors on the buy side. But we didn't have direct access because that's not who IEX's customers were. IEX's customers are brokers. And every time we'd ask a question, well, why are brokers doing this or why are brokers acting this way? There's no insight available into that because brokers are this black box. And thinking about this coming from cryptography is all about keeping secrets, but they are much less secretive than this. Because fundamentally, whenever somebody comes to the cryptography community and says, I have a cool new way of encrypting data, but I can't tell you how it works, we laugh at that person and we break their system immediately. Because usually I can't tell you how it works means it's not going to stand up to scrutiny. And the reason we believe in the encryption algorithms that we have is that they've been exposed to decades of people trying to break them and improving them and all these things. So it seemed crazy to me that the science of electronic trading algorithms, of how to route in certain ways or how to build a design a schedule or how to optimize to certain goals for order performance, that was all individualized inside these black boxes instead of benefiting from a open science culture, that seemed completely handicapped to me as a scientific field and completely unnecessary, because there's obviously things that need to be protected and confidential, like what stock are you trading and when are you trading it? But if I'm claiming to you that I have a way of taking big trades and breaking them up into pieces in the market so that they blend in with the noise, if they really blend in, then I should be able to tell you my mechanism and it should still work. And if I'm forced to expose that mechanism, it should open up all of the surface for public science and collaboration that should help us get much better outcomes. So I'm a big believer in making science public whenever there's not a great reason to do otherwise, rather than secrecy being the default. So one of the main things we wanted to solve for as a broker was to make as much of our decision-making process public as we could. So to make us more accountable, to open that up as a surface for a collaboration with our clients, that if we tell them what we're doing, they can say, oh, well, that's not aligned with our goals in this case. And that's a much more rich surface for communication and improvement than us just saying, here's the box, you can use it or not. So it was kind of our hope that bringing a scientific process into the open in this area would really jumpstart progress towards better solutions.
Proof's been around since 2019. You weathered through COVID beautifully, but how did that go? How is the business? And what are some of the biggest things you're working on?
I think the weathering through COVID was not as structurally hard for us as it could have been because we were set up to be a remote company pretty much from the get-go. Part of that was one of the reasons for us leaving IEX when we did was that Dan wanted to move to California. And in 2019, IEX was not remote friendly. So we decided to be. And then we also hired an employee who was working from Toronto. So we were set up to be remote. But it was very unfortunate timing in the sense that I really would have wanted to be a fly in the wall while our tech system was being built by our technical co-founders. I would have learned a lot from that process. I would have driven them crazy. They're probably thankful that I could not do this. But even though we knew each other well and we were set up for remote work, it does change the culture of a company and it put us in a much more, I think, brittle position that knowledge wasn't as naturally shared across the team as it would have been. So that's something we're figuring out now how to correct, still as a remote company, because I think the possibilities for remote work in terms of inclusion and being able to be nimble and to support employees in many different situations across different visa circumstances and all sorts of things is just such a positive benefit. But we're still trying to figure out how do we still make sure that information is flowing across teams and gets us into a more resilient position. So we're going to do a company-wide in-person retreat this June, which is going to be nice. And also, I should say, part of our answer to this too is just never planning to really be huge in terms of personnel. We do think that we've built a pretty scalable system and we can run it pretty lean. In the great case where our business really scales and grows, we might be a company of 30 people in that case, whereas today we're 6, but we're not really planning to be a company of 1,000 people. We just don't think it takes that many people to do what we do.
Can you give me an example of what proof trading does for a client?
So our main contribution to the process of trading is that once a client has decided they want to buy a large amount of stock or sell a large amount of stock, our job is to figure out how do we take that and split it over time and space into pieces so that the market doesn't disproportionately react. How do we make their total activity blend in with the random activity of the market in such a way that we can get done what they want to get done without the price going up because they're buying or going down because they're selling? So it's reducing impact relative to getting the trade that you want. That is the value that we're looking to add. One thing that's very tricky about this process is that the market is very noisy. So there's a lot of noise in the data performance. And it's very hard to compare two algorithms apples to apples because they get different kinds of orders in different market conditions, a huge sample size. So it's a very tough sales position in that I can't point to a single order. Look, this is the amount of money we saved you. And people seem to expect that, which seems super weird to me that we go into these sales calls. So explain to me how many basis points your algorithm is going to save me versus my competitors. One, your competitors won't tell me anything about their performance. So how would I know that? And two, I can't even measure my own performance cleanly because it's a function of all this noise. And so get a lot of befuddled expressions on the other side. It's like, well, then what are you selling? We think we're better. We just also think this is really hard to show, and I'm not going to show you some half-baked thing.
You've been doing this now for several years. Your prior academic career, it seemed like every few years you would want to switch or get another degree. Now that it's been more than a handful of years here, do you like the industry? Are you mesmerized by it? Do you imagine staying within the investment world?
I have no idea. I think there's plenty of problems here to be worked on. And it's a place where I definitely feel I can be impactful, that I can work on these fundamental or shaping things. And so from that perspective, I'm happy with it. I think I'm also just a person who's never happy doing one thing. So I'm still simultaneously doing some teaching on the side. I teach part-time at City College and simultaneously working on some writing stuff and comedy stuff. So that gives me a good balance right now in terms of that I do get to teach and work on the startup with a good amount of energy and enthusiasm because I have these other outlets. So I also find it very funny as a startup founder how often you're asked, where do you see yourself in 10 years? Where do you see yourself in 20 years? I'm thinking about what's due tomorrow. It's like, I'm thinking about what's down the line 2 years from now. Beyond that, have any of these things ever come true? We look back at the what startup founders said early in their startup and then what happened. Are we really so sure all this time spent on vision is time well spent? Because it never really works out. A lot of my energy is spent on the time scales of a day, a week, a year, 2 years at most. So I haven't spent a lot of cycles recently thinking about where I'll be 5 years from now, but who can say?
I think the people who do say it's cherry-picked in terms of this lens of success, well, this is what the VCs do, and they have the 5, the 7, the 10-year plan. But I think oftentimes the numbers actually show it's more like that Mike Tyson quote of everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face and that changes. And so I will make sure to link your website and Proof Trading's website. And I highly recommend the listeners go to your website because you could tell you're a complete Renaissance woman because you have so many different interests and you're fluent in so many different subjects. But your humor is something that comes across so well and vividly. And I was reading an interview you did for, it was the top women in fintech in New York. And it was go through your daily diary or things that you do in your workday. And most people will do a 9-to-5. Here's all my meetings. Here's my workflow. And yours is spectacular and goes through a couple of days, but talks about just everything from your dog to the actual and I think accurate description of workflow that is so funny. So I won't steal its thunder, but I highly recommend reading that as well. I'll just pivot to the questions I ask everybody. And we haven't even touched on so much of your extracurricular activities, from the comedy stuff, the boxing things, and I want to get into it. But I'll start with, who or what inspires you?
And that, I think, does go straight to the comedy and the boxing, because the things that inspire me tend to be things outside my professional career, but I still find resonance in them that I bring into my professional career. From a comedy standpoint, one of the most inspiring comedians that I've ever seen is Tig Notaro. So if your listeners don't know who she is, she's amazing. She's particularly famous for a stand-up special in which she talks about surviving cancer, having her mother die, and being dumped within a very short span of time. And the way that she uses comedy as a tool to process and connect with people through those experiences is just incredible. And that was something that I happened to listen to at a point in my life where I was processing some pretty severe personal trauma. And it was just one of those moments of, had I not listened to that, I might not be where I am today. It was a lifeline in the darkness to just hear somebody work through that in a public-facing way. It was just amazing.
I've actually never heard of her, Tig Notaro. She's now on my radar. Amazing. Does she have a few specials, or where would you recommend someone starting to consume her work?
She has some full stand-up specials. She has some albums. She had a show, I'm blanking on the name now, but it had Mississippi in it, I think, on Amazon Video. There's a half hour set that she did that she's most famous for that is probably the place to start. But then she does have some full HBO specials.
Did you have a mentor or role model growing up? And it sounds like you moved around a lot. Your dad was admissions professor in college, so you could have had a lot of really interesting conversations about that during the dinner table. But who, if you had any, were role models or mentors?
I think one in college and then one now. So the college professor who taught the number theory course that got me into math was Jordan Ellenberg. And he's now a tenured math professor at Wisconsin. And he's been an incredible mentor because he's also a person who does math and writes fiction. So he had a fiction novel that came out while I was an undergrad. And that was really inspiring to me as a person who manages to live in these different worlds and also follow his outside passions while being a very successful mathematician. And he was a great mentor, too, from an aspect of encouraging me in math and encouraging me that I could do math without having to give up all the other things that I do. Whereas many people in math gave me the advice that you have to live and breathe math or every day, all the time. Why are you doing all these other things? They're going to make you a worse mathematician. And he had the total opposite advice. And so that was super helpful for me. And then a mentor that I look up to now is actually my boxing coach, who started her own business as a boxing trainer here in New York and now owns her own gym as the Women's World of Boxing in Harlem, which we just celebrated the 5-year anniversary of the gym. And that's one of my absolute favorite places that I go whenever I need to feel calm in a space. And so she just brings such a positive energy to her work every day. And that's definitely an example for how I want to be in the world.
It sounds like you are already, but that's amplified by the people that you surround yourself with. Going back to Jordan, my husband would be very happy to know that because we have a few of his books, but the one that he really enjoyed was How Not to Be Wrong.
I love that book. Yeah.
Just about mathematical thinking, but that's right up his alley. But that's amazing to know. What are you most proud of so far?
I'm actually the founder of a conference called CFAIL for Failed Approaches and Insightful Losses in Cryptology. So this is an annual event where we give people a platform to talk about research that didn't ultimately succeed in whatever they were trying to do. So it's whether they tried to prove something and they couldn't, or they tried to build something and it was broken. And that has been, I think, just one of the funnest and most energizing research conferences that I've been a part of. People getting really embracing talking about failure. So I think it's great that you're doing this podcast and highlighting these stories because, yeah, it's really worked for us in the research community too to have that platform.
I'm curious because I love how you think, especially in the investment world, it's a very, I would say, less creative in thought than most. And you sound like a very creative person applied in a very quantitatively oriented structure and mindset. What does success mean to you? In our world, it's clearly defined with more zeros in your balance sheet and commas. or performance, your daily P&L. But for you personally, you go down different rabbit holes because it sounds like you're curious and just want to have fun and have impact. And so that's a really beautiful mission. What does success look like for you?
I think for me, success is more about processes than outcomes. And that's the thing that I do think is still true in finance, even if it's not recognized, because the outcomes are a function of so many random things that you don't control, but the processes you have full control over. And so to me as a scientist, success means following a scientific rigorous process that I know it's working when I'm learning new things, I'm asking new questions, and I'm able to iterate on what I'm doing and make meaningful progress. But it's not necessarily about hitting a certain target metric. It's about following the right process. And I think in our industry in particular, it's so easy to get process wrong and end up cherry picking data, whether intentionally or unintentionally. And a lot of times unintentionally, because I think there's this very human thing of, I have a guess at what I think is happening and I run the numbers and it doesn't pan out. So, oh, I must have done it wrong. Let me change this and run the numbers again. And even just very basic things. If you run a test over all stock and you look at the bar of statistical significance, a 5% chance. Yeah, but you ran it over 1,000 stock. If you get 50 hits, that's what you would expect to happen randomly. And in that environment, I think we need so much discipline around process. And so for me, success is always how much impact and how much scale and growth can I get for my company while maintaining a really high bar on our process. And I think of it as process first and then the outcomes second.
It's so funny you mentioned that, taking, if you can, the human element out of it to the extent possible. And I remember in the first year of COVID when the markets were going ballistic and it was level up, level down every day for 2 or 3 weeks straight. And one CIO of an endowment that I was talking with at the time, he'd said, we know that human behavior wants to react. And so we want to remove it to the extent we can possible. And so he said, for the next, whatever, 2-3 months during COVID, as the markets are going wild, here's the levels for every manager and every stock that we had in our portfolio. And when it goes from 5 to 10, 10 to 15, we'll add if these are high conviction metrics. And it's so interesting because, as he said, a few managers and stocks got to the down 20 to 25. Their process said this, and then they changed it in that moment. They're like, oh, you know what? We're going to change that because that made us uncomfortable. And it's just so funny because that literally was designed to remove that exact thing.
That was the entire point. Yeah.
Yeah. It made me so laugh. So one question I haven't asked yet, and you alluded to a few struggles and failure moments, but I'm curious if you can share your most impactful failure or struggle. And inevitably, I'm assuming that allowed for a lot of growth. And so you'd mentioned a little bit about going through a personally trying time or not getting into the creative writing program at Princeton. But what was the most transformative, if you can share, failure moment?
I'll share one specific one, which is not the worst, and then I'll talk a little bit about the worst. But one specific one that's a funny, informative story was right after graduating high school. I was at this high school near Ithaca. And what's relevant about that is that Cornell was one of the university teams that was involved in the Mars Rover project at that time. And somebody must have written into a grant somewhere that they were supposed to have high school student interns at the Mars Rover field tests, which were the last tests before the rover actually went up. And they were scrambling at the last minute. They forgot to do it. Oh, we need an 18-year-old. We can fly out to JPL tomorrow. And so my high school guidance counselor got a call and then called me and was like, do you want to go to the Jet Propulsion Lab to watch the Mars Rover field test as an intern? Yes. Okay. So I just get put on a flight 48 hours later or something. And I'm there for a week while they're doing field testing in the Mojave Desert. And as an intern, I was given this one job. And my job was related to the fact they're simulating real conditions for the rover, and the rover can only talk back to Earth at certain times of day. And so they would have to queue up 12 hours of directions and commands for the rover to perform, and then the rover would do them, and then it would get to a place where it could talk again, and it would send back all the results. And my job was to, and they were simulating this in the field test, every 12 hours, they would simulate and come back. My job was to take all the files that came back and match them up with the commands. If the command was take a picture at this angle and then the picture came back, and I would match them up so the scientists could see what had happened. And I was supposed to do this in a spreadsheet and then email it to this email address. And I did this every day for a week. And at the end of this process, we were in a meeting with the scientists and they were asking like, well, for next year, what would it be good to have the interns do? And somebody goes, it would have been super helpful to have an intern matching up the files with the commands. And I'm sitting in the back, wait, I say nothing. And I come out, and it turns out they gave me the wrong email address to send it to. So the whole week I had been feeling I was contributing, helping them plan these things. And there even was a day where, so there was dependencies in their navigational system where they had to have certain pictures, certain coverage of pictures before they could plan a drive. If they hadn't taken the static pictures, the rover couldn't navigate. And I knew from doing these lists of commands this one day that they hadn't taken pictures. So I knew they weren't going to be able to move this day, basically. And I sit in the meeting where they're deciding what to do, and they have 2 hours to decide what to do. And they spend about an hour and 45 minutes planning a drive. And I know that they can't. And I am way too shy as an 18-year-old to say anything. And 15 minutes left in the meeting, one of the scientists goes, "Oh, wait, we can't drive today." I mentioned this not because of a big failure. Obviously, there were some structural things that were not quite well put together for this intern program. But it really brought home to me the importance of being willing to look stupid, being willing to ask questions. And I think that's a big thing that I've taken into my scientific career, is that it's okay if half the time it ends up that it was stupid, because half the time it wasn't. Half the time it's important to check that someone's getting it right.
I love that story so much. You're also like, hello, I'm right here. Yes, offense.
Yeah, the whole time. And the Mars rover is a huge scientific success. So these things get pulled together at the last minute. In terms of my biggest failure, I alluded to the fact that during grad school and early faculty career, I was dealing with some pretty severe personal stuff that involves other people. So I'm not really going to go into the details of it. But I will say, as a growth moment, it was pretty significant because I was having symptoms of depression and PTSD as a young faculty member. And what was strange to me about it was that my ability to function and do my job was the last thing to go. I was not sleeping. I was not eating well. Everything was off. And yet I was still publishing papers and teaching classes on paper. Everything looked fine. And I had to convince myself that it was bad enough to heal, to give myself permission to heal. And I think one of the things that surprised me about that process was it was less of a growth of, let me take in this new experience and absorb it and iterate and grow. It was more almost shedding a limb, just completely resetting. And that was actually the time a lot of people have asked me about this since, when I started dyeing my hair blue and purple, and I started getting tattoos that were meaningful to me and changing my appearance. I felt like I was walking through the world looking like this person that I wasn't able to be anymore. And having people react to her the same way they used to react to her was stopping me from healing. People would expect things of me, and I would do them because that's what I'd always done. And so I needed to find a way to change what people expected of me. And so I think one of the biggest things was reclaiming my physical presentation and space. And that was also when I started learning boxing and just changing the way I move in the world. So for me, I think the biggest growth moment was realizing that sometimes you need to reset and you need to reclaim some of the things that are in the way of that progress, and giving myself permission also to quit as a faculty member, which I would not say is a failure. I think a lot of academics think of leaving academia as always intrinsically a failure. It definitely was not. It's definitely a continuation of my journey. But the willingness to be seen as a failure in that sense, I think, was really important.
How long were you in that period of pre-transformation that you were unhappy, depressed, and going through that low?
I think about 5 years. So it was not a short-term thing. I think it was somewhat of a drastic change at some point that it just became unsustainable. I'm just going to start doing things differently. And it was also one of those processes of just seeing all the people in your life, who reacts to that in what ways, and who your real support network going forward is going to be. And so I'm very lucky that I have a lot of really good friends and really good people in my life. Things are going to be different now. Got it. Don't have to tell me twice, which was pretty amazing.
Are you a fan of George Carlin?
Yes.
I think about him because I just watched his documentary or halfway through it, and I started it on a plane. I didn't know much about him. I only knew him with his later content, and getting the background of his rise, his success, and then his transformation, and then another 2.0 type of success is deeply inspiring to me. But it reminds me of yours in terms of the transformation physically, because here's someone who's on this variety show, and he always had the suit and the short hair, and it looks really clean cut. And still, he had started doing a little bit more provocative content that wasn't well received. People are expecting me to be a certain way. Hold on. And so I love that he just transformed did the long hair, did the beard, did a different look, not suit and tie. And I just am inspired by people who are so self-aware that take time to reflect and then don't care what people think, which is the simplest thing to say, but I think the hardest thing to do and achieve.
And I think it's also one of these things to realize that we have more control over setting people's expectations for us. And I think it takes a certain amount of separation from people's reaction to you. Just realize that that lever is there to some extent. And for me, it really came out of a place of necessity and from feeling it in myself. I would wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and see this person that I didn't feel existed anymore. And that was this weird disconnecting feeling. So getting it back to feeling where I felt connected. And this is always the biggest thing I tell people thinking about public speaking or comedy is that if you make yourself laugh, it's contagious. If you're getting on stage and you want to convey an emotion or you're pitching your startup or whatever, if you feel it, the audience will feel it. And so it's getting to the point where you feel good about what you're doing or you feel excited about what you're doing is 90% of it. And the rest is just icing on the cake.
If you could speak to Allison right after college, and I'm going to use maybe Princeton College versus all your other colleges, what would you tell her?
I'd be a person in the movie theater screaming at the horror movie, don't split up! What are you doing? It's about to get really bad. But I'll sort of interpret that as to what I would tell myself, I think almost generally at any age, which is that you're smart enough to do everything you want to do, but you're dumber than you think you are, so be careful.
I love that advice. Whether it's right after college or even in my 40s, I will take it. Last question, what's next for Allison Bishop?
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I have no idea. Hopefully, my startup continuing to grow and going on for that. One funny thing that I'm adding to my schedule in the fall is despite having already way too many degrees that a single person doesn't need, I'm actually going back to school for creative writing part-time. It has taken me this long to get over the rejection of the Princeton Creative Writing Program. And I also tried while I was at Columbia to take a creative writing course because they had this program where as a faculty, you could take a course for free. And my benefit didn't vest until it was too late. I wasn't able to do it. And I was so sad. And I had even emailed the creative writing professor. My benefit hasn't vested yet, but I'd like to sit in on the course. And they said, no. And so this has been my white whale. I want to take creative writing. So I'm starting as a part-time student in the MFA program at City College this fall to take one creative writing course at a time. And I'm super excited about it.
I love it. Although I don't know, the universe is telling you to stay away from writing somehow and just go on math and crypto. So I have a feeling there's going to be something crazy that happens before your first week of class. I hope not, but that would be amazing.
I hope not too. We'll see.
Allison, thank you so much for this interview. I had such a blast talking with you, learning from you, and I look forward to seeing what else you do next.
Thank you so much for having me.